Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of Bilge Pumps. Now, before I get into reintroducing our wonderful guest, Steve George, and my two amazing colleagues, Drac and Jamie, I want to point out something. This is the six-month mark, and as it's that point in terms of us having produced these podcasts, we thought we'd check the data and see where our listeners have been in the last week. And so we are going to say hello, especially to the two people in the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago who are listening. Hello, you two. We hope you're having a good time. The seven people in the Isle of Man, hello. We've also got 17 people in the Kingdom of Bahrain. Thank you. We're not quite sure what's going on between the People's Republic of China and Taiwan, in that 1 week the PRC has 45 listeners and Taiwan has 44. And then the next week they swap over, and then the next week they swap over again, as if they're in a constant competition for that 45th person to see who's going to push them up in their listeners. We also have to say hello to the 297 people in New Zealand. We are slightly disturbed by the fact that the 304 people in Belgium are listening more than you. So we think New Zealand, come on. Don't we say, and don't we have an express enough love for HMS New Zealand and HMS Maori on this show? And, well, it goes up to quite quickly to the 2020 people in Canada. Thank you.
How many different Falklands again?
One in the Falklands. One. Hello to the one in the Falkland Islands. We've got 2,500 and, well, probably 18 in the Commonwealth of Australia, considering I'm hoping the Jamie to check in. Then United Kingdom, Great Britain, Northern Ireland. That's 5,507 and probably about 600 of those are various universities, people I'm affiliated with, checking that I'm not slagging off their university. And a whopping 17,178 in the US of A. So thank you, America. You are taking us to your hearts and we love you for it.
We better stop trashing the Littoral Combat Ship.
No, probably we should continue trashing it because that's probably why they're listening. So, yes, we have had a lot of listeners last week. So thank you very much to everyone. And thank you to everyone for being here. As said, I'm joined by Drac and Jamie, but we're also joined by possibly one of the most favorite guests we've had so far on the show.
What?
Steve George. We cannot explain the reaction that there's been to him on our Discords. If you have been on Minor Drac's Discord servers, you will have seen it. The fact that we had this wonderful erudite engineer come on and explain what it was like in the Falklands War and explain his experiences and go through it in such detail has amazed them. What we did hint then was that he'll be back to talk about another project and what he's been doing since the Falklands War, because he's done lots of other engineering projects since the Falklands War. He didn't stop engineering then. No, no, no. He's been engineering the world in which we live in very much so since then. It includes the F-35. And Jamie is particularly excited about this because Steve is finally going to answer questions that Jamie's been having for about the last decade, trying to get out of people and not being able to get an actual answer. And what's amazing.
And these aren't even the sorts of questions that will get me shot for hearing the answer.
These are just sort of basic things,
answer.
So it's going to be, frankly, it's going to make Jamie's day. It's making mine and Drac's day. And we hope Steve is going to enjoy himself as much as we are. So without much further ado, hello, gents. How are we all doing?
Hello, sir.
Thank you very much for coming back and putting up with us.
Pleasure.
Much fun is had by all, I'm sure. Yes, well, look, you know, naturally I was fascinated to hear that you were involved in the whole development process for the F-35. I guess, you know, that is one of the most controversial, I suppose, in many ways, projects for a long time, largely because of its great expense, largely because of its delays. But again, you know, it's one of those situations where we just don't know what we don't know. And it's as a reporter who's occasionally been asked to look into things such as, you know, test pilot critiques and United States Audit Office questions, I very rarely ever managed to find or hear the other side of the story as it was, because, you know, I'd put in a request to Lockheed or I'd put in a request to the Australian Air Force, and if I was lucky, I might hear back 10 weeks later saying, no, we're not going to talk to you. So, you know, it's one of those things where I fear that a large deal of negative mythology has built up around the aircraft, largely because no one's been brave enough to dispel it. But then again, it may also be that that mythology has got an element of truth in it. So hopefully you can set us all straight here.
Okay. I think I'd start by making the observation. You mentioned the US General Accounting Office. I would say that if you contrast the F-35 program with programs like Typhoon, Rafale, and any of the Russian ones, there's more data and more knowledge out on it than any other major defense program I've ever seen. There is tons of detail out there if you know where to look. The Congressional Research Service reports are freely available as well. And so there's actually quite a lot there. You know, so you know, I mean, in terms of why it's been late, you can find that. I think, Alex, before I go any further, I think it might be helpful to explain why I think I'm slightly qualified to say a few things about the F-35.
You're more than welcome to, Steve, but let's be honest, in our minds, especially after the last time, you're more than qualified to talk about whatever you choose to talk about, frankly.
Well, that's in my mind. Let me just give the guys a quick recast of what I did after the Falklands. And it was a not atypical career progression for a fairly average engineer. After I completed my time on 820, I went off to do a Master of Science at Cranfield. I then went to DGAN and NATEC, which was at Leon Sullivan, which was the Naval Air Technical Evaluation Center. And for a few years, I was the head of the Fleet Air Arms Non-Destructive Testing and Vibration Analysis team. It's quite good. I then got pinged for an exchange job, which in the Fleet Air Arm normally means you're going to go to Shearwater or California. In my case, I went to Hull and I went and worked as a project manager with BAE at Brough on the T-45 Goshawk. So I was the deputy program manager for the T-45 Goshawk, which gave me an insight into what you need to do to a land-based airframe to get it on and off a ship. I then went off to join 801 Squadron as their AEO, their Air Engineer Officer, embarked in HMS Ark Royal. Did that for about 20 months. Then became the Senior Aircraft Engineer at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, looking after about 130 planes, Gulf War One, all that. Bosnia, Kurdistan, Bangladesh, Northern Ireland, quite a few mods. Then I got pinged to be the Harrier Fleet Engineering Manager, where I bought the Sea Harrier FA-2 into service, which gave me an insight into more modern radars and missiles. I then got picked up for Commander, unbelievably, and went off to the Ministry of Defence in D-Air Arm, Director Aircraft Armaments. I had a small team, and my team was buying all the weapons for the Apache. We were buying miniguns, flares, CRV-7 rockets, the big machine gun on the side of the Lynx. Oh, and the 25mm Aiden gun for the Harrier GR-7, which got canned. So quite a good job, ranging all the way from 540 bombs to countermeasures. I then, from there, I got picked up to go to Washington, D.C., and I was a technical desk in the British Embassy, and I was, the mod procurement executive guy looking after the JSF. So I was handling all the visits and that to do with the JSF, as was at that time. I came back, I then joined the team who were putting together Joint Force Harrier, the light blue adoption of the, you know, to form this joint force of GR7s and Shahs. So I went to RAF High Wycombe, and I finally made the decision to leave the Navy in 2001. I left as a commander. After that, I joined BAE, and I got picked up to go out to Fort Worth, where for a while out in Fort Worth, for a couple of years, I was on the basing and ship suitability team, which was a small team of specialists who were basically the subject matter experts on putting aircraft on board ships. And my brief originally was to look after putting the F-35B on the new British carriers. I have to stress, it's not like I was in charge. I was a subject matter expert who was really monitoring and hopefully guiding the work done by all the other thousands of good people there at Fort Worth. But it did give me a very deep insight into the F-35. I must stress, I was not a senior chap there. I was really fairly low grade, but I did get a good amount of technical info. Came back, worked with BA for another couple of years on that, on the evolving the nature of putting the ship on the deck. And then eventually I'd really had enough of that, became a contractor, and ended up managing defensive aid system upgrades for a British military helicopter. So that's the two bits there that, you know, I'd had the time in the British Embassy when I got to know quite a few people involved, and then subsequently working with the BAE. So that's my base of experience.
And I would just point out that Steve is doing his classic, and I would say, you could say it's classic British, but he is very, very even more classic British than anything of understating things there. Because if you didn't hear it, the first naval committee you were involved in, the sort of naval forces, it always sounds like quite a prosaic name when you say it out loud. It's the thing which makes sure the aircraft doesn't shake apart when it has weapons loaded on and that the weapons don't drop off. So it's kind of important if you want to get a modern war to actually work. And as for the rest, I would also add, if ever you talk to Lockheed Martin or anyone else in who I've managed to talk with over the F-35 and all these years, if Steve George's name comes up, they usually go, ah, yes. He always has good ideas.
No,
it just comes up. Oh, good solutions guy comes up. And that's basically is the highest. Drac is of course, our resident engineer. If you hear a fellow engineer described as a good solutions guy, what does that mean, Drac?
Well, it means you found the only other sane and competent person in the organisation.
Many, many very good people out there.
So
look, the F-35, I mean, obviously the B was very much a joint British-American project because of the driving need to replace the Sea Harrier, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. The UK's position on JSF as the only tier one partner was as a direct result of the UK Stovall experience. And in fact, the MOU between the UK and the US governments was titled the Stovall MOU. So that gives you a clue as to why we got in at tier one. And yes, I forget the number of the naval staff requirement. 6466 is one that jumps out at me. That's probably wrong. But yes, it was the post Falklands work, say, well, going forward, what do we really need? And that naval staff requirement was really written it with an air defence emphasis, but with a naval background. The other thing I would say, and I think I'm very glad to have the chance to put this up, and I can't mention the names, but you'll understand why, is the desk I took over in Washington, D.C. had been filled by Royal Navy AEOs for some time. And a predecessor of mine was absolutely instrumental in building personal relationships with some of the key U.S. people who were looking at Stovall in the wake of the British, basically the end of the UK-US Stovall work that lasted, I think, from the late 60s, about the late 60s, right the way through to the early 80s. And that joint work did lay a lot of the groundwork for the JSF. But my predecessor maintained a lot of good contacts, and he maintained contacts with the American technical groups who were doing really important stuff. So, yes, it was our industrial Stovall expertise that was important, but the interpersonal work that was done to keep the UK front and centre. So as our naval staff requirement began to emerge, he made sure that the US guys knew what we were doing and we knew what they were doing. He also was able to, at the appropriate time, provide information on a black program, which the USMC were running, which was called the SSF, the Stovall Strike Fighter, which was the sort of outgrowth of some of the US Stovall work. And that was, if you like, the first baby step along the way to the F-35B. So that's really why the UK were there, and that's why we became, you know, so important.
So can you tell us a bit about the development of those requirements and the, the horse trading that goes on behind the scenes between governments and between companies and between, naval staff requirements? Because there's a lot of things that needed to be crowded into one aircraft.
Okay. I can't tell you that. I can't tell you much about the horse trading between the governments. I was involved in just getting the visits or clearance for a lot of the meetings, but I'm not going to give you very much there. But I can tell you a little bit about the requirements process. Perhaps I can take you back one. Why the program in the first place? You know, a lot of people ask, why did we try and do all these three aircraft at once? You know, why didn't we do separate aircraft? And wasn't the F-111 a big enough example?
Or even the Skua, really.
Yeah. Let me start.
As long as you
by...
don't mention the Blackburn, we're okay.
One of the contacts that my predecessor bequeathed to me was a very, very, was in fact, sorry, bit of background. In the Pentagon, you have the armed services, you have the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. You also have the Office of the Secretary of Defense. That's like the center of the Pentagon. And that's the real point at which all the budgets and programs get really run and approved. And one of the contacts I always bequeathed was the guy who was in charge of the tactical air programs for the Office of the Secretary of Defense. This was the guy who was writing the briefs on the F-22 to the Secretary of Defense. And I was bequeathed this arrangement where every so often I could meet him and he could meet me and we could just chat about what's going on in our patch. So he gave me quite an insight into what was going on. And he was the guy who came up with the JSF. began as something called CARF, Common Affordable Lightweight Fighter, then became JAST, Joint Advanced Strike Technology, so it's a technology demonstrator program. Then it became JSF. Okay, why were they doing it? Because if you cast your mind back to the early, mid 90s, the Americans were looking back at 12-year trail of wreckage of large twin-engine, twin-seat tactical fighter aircraft programs and strike programs. I can go through the list. AFX, NATF, AFX, A-12, F-22, which this guy considered to be a failed program. Okay. They were originally a 1,000 aircraft program that ended up building 138. They came to the conclusion that the only way to break the spiral of cost, now, yeah, it's very easy. Well, they did a great job about that, but put yourself where they are, where they were. And they said, okay, it's going to be single engine, single seat. We're going to leverage technology, particularly the emerging avionics, to make it single seat. So you don't need two people. You don't need a front and back seat. It's got to be single engine to keep the cost down, because if you go twin engine, they just grew. And the F-14 was going off the cap, what, about £74,000? It's a monstrous thing. So they pushed that, and then they got the idea that if you put Stovall in, that would force it to be single engine, because you can't make a twin engine Stovall plane. For a while, Lockheed and Northrop, in the end, they just made it single seat. And that was because one of the early competitors had a propulsion jet engine at the back and a jet engine at the front. It said, oh, it can't be, you know, it wasn't single. The other thing that had been paralleled along out of the A Stovall work going to the US and UK was an enormous amount of work into lift engine tech and lift fans and how they were driven. And in fact, they ran big rigs with gas-driven fans, electrically driven fans, shaft-driven fans. And the other big thing that was going on was advances in engine technology, because they worked out to make a Stovall aircraft work, you needed about a 25 to 30% improvement in the specific fuel consumption and in thrust to weight. And that technology was emerging out of many of the key American gas turbine technology works. IPTET, Integrated High Performance Turbine Engine Technology, was a program I think that still runs to this day. So all of that came together through JAST and really flowed into the rationale of JSF. So requirements. So you've got the technology, but you've got to write a requirement. They took a very, very deliberate view, and what they did was they had about a 4-year process, developed a thing called the JAWD, the Joint Operational Requirements Document. And they had three steps towards it, which were called the JIRDs, the Joint Interim Research Requirements Document, JIRD 1, JIRD 2, JIRD 3. So they put JIRD 1 together, and the sort of aircraft with capabilities that would meet that in concert with the companies were run through a number of simulations. Now, these are not a guy sitting in a cockpit. These are big campaign sims, loss rates, threat stuff. And it's very easy to lob bricks at those, but it's about as good as you're going to get. And they did three runs at this over about 3.5-4 years work. The UK was involved with that. So they did three runs around that thing, wringing out what they really had to have. Another big innovation of JSF was that the requirements document would be at a system requirements document level. So in fact, it emerged out of the process as the Jord with only about 128 lines, which is amazingly brief. So, for instance, line one I happen to know on the Jord was, "This shall be a single seat." This will be a single seat. There will be two control in sectors. You know, they have made certain quite high level. So, for instance, the area I worked in, the JSF air system shall be capable of operating from and being supported by the following ships. That's it. I've just given you more or less the entire statement of requirement for working from the ship. There was also one which was UK specific. It shall be capable of executing a ski jump takeoff from an Invincible class ski jump. There were a couple of other swans, but in general, it was a high level document. That document also was married up with things called KPPs, key performance parameters. In requirements speak, KPP is basically something you can't trade away. You have to meet it. And the number of KPPs on JSF, I'm going from memory, is remarkably small. It's about 13, some of which were very classified. The mission systems ones were, and the low observability. And I was nowhere near those, so I'm not going to sit and say, "Well, I knew them." I can't say it. I just didn't know what they were. But as far as the aircraft performance went, it was remarkably light. There were no requirements for G. There was no requirements for top speed. There were indications of desired, but they chose the KPPs very carefully indeed to drive the aircraft's overall design. When you put requirements on an aircraft, you can put a requirement in that absolutely drives that plane. It might not be the one you want to do it. So, for instance, the Swordfish original Star of Quad, I believe, had a requirement for a very slow landing speed. So, of course,
55 knots.
Yeah. So they ended up with a biplane, because that's the only way you're going to meet that. The one on the F-35B that jumps out is that the aircraft, all three variants, had an internal weapons carriage requirement, which drove the size of the bomb bays. And it is notable, if you look at those KPPs, and you can still find them, that the B was only ever required to carry two 1,000-pound JDAMs. The A and C was carried 2,000-pounders. The reason was the smart guys at the JPO, the JSF program office, had worked out that the F-35B would be short of internal space. So they decided to cut them a break. The other key thing was called the vertical landing bring-back capability. And that was that the F-35B had to be able to land with two internal 1,000-pounders, two internal 120s. That's about 3,200-pound weapons. Now, I'm here to tell you that there are very, very few normal carrier-borne aircraft that can land back on and catch the wire with that amount of weaponry on board. There are plenty of land-based aircraft that can't get back with that amount of bombs on board. So that was a big ask. But it was deliberate.
Having to drop that sort of stuff would get not only very expensive very fast, but I imagine for a carrier which has only got a limited capacity of weaponry on board, you could rapidly diminish your stocks of weaponry that way.
Well, yeah, you can't go around doing that, and it's also, by the way, the small fact that it's forbidden under the Montreal Protocol.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I can tell you that was certainly something that weighed on people's minds. You can't go throwing loads and loads of bombs away into the sea. Not unless you're prepared to go back and pick them up again. And that can be a bit expensive.
Yes, and so can the payouts to the poor old fishing family on holidays. So
true. So, you know, I mean, it's so vertical landing bring back was very, very important right from the start for a powered lift aircraft. And it was a well-chosen KPP.
Challenging?
Damn challenging. Well, you know, as I said, you're asking this to bring back more tonnage than a tornado can land back with on a runway.
Okay, so you need a lot. So it's not just a case of having the thrust to weight ratio enough to lift the aircraft. You've got to have enough thrust to weight ratio to lift or lower safely the aircraft, plus whatever fuel that's got on board, plus all the weaponry.
Oh, Lord, yeah. Yeah, and by the way, you've got to be able to do it with enough fuel to go around again if you don't do it at night. So it's at the bottom of a full IMC approach. So it's a non-trivial, and all of the KPPs were chosen. Incidentally, the KPP for the F-35C was the carrier approach speed. That's the speed at which it takes the wire, which is also, by the way, amazingly sensitive to weight. Amazingly sensitive to weight. Okay, so does that really ask you, you know, sort of all of the nations were involved in that. And in fact, we had a sea carrier pilot in the JSF PO for about 4 years. I think he got it extended, and he was extremely good. And when I used to do the rounds in Washington, people would talk about this guy in awe, absolutely in awe, because he was excellent. He had a big, you know, big parts to play. But of course, everybody had to give a bit. At that point, by the way, it's fair saying that the UK was led by the MOG PE, and of course, at this time, the customer was the Navy. So it was dark blue people at the time I was involved in the DC. The guys were mostly dark blue, and in fact, the guy predecessor in my desk went on to become the first full time Ministry of Defence guy in the JSF program office. So he finished his job in DC, and then he went back there again in rig as the first Royal Navy guy there.
Jamie, I think you had a question. I do, but I know you have one.
No, you go for it. It sort of just decided to fly out of my head as soon as I was about to ask it.
Well, you see, I will admit this is the first time. Usually, when we have guests on, if there is a briefing sent, usually it's me who writes up the briefing, or Jamie who writes up the briefing, and then we send it. Drax got a guest coming on next week, so we're going to see if he writes up a briefing for it. This time, Steve actually wrote up a briefing and sent it to us with ideas of things. And I've been reading this and rereading it since he sent it. And what I love is A, the candor, and this shows you the quality of the engineer we're dealing with, in that he's fully candor. But he does talks about why is the program being such an, why has it had so many issues? And you've already mentioned the comparison with the Typhoons, the Tornadoes, F-22s, etc., and all of them have results. And you've talked about requirements management, but there is the points B and D, which are optimism bias and weight control. And I do wonder if perhaps weight control was actually, to an extent, a product of the optimism bias, in that everyone kept presuming everything would be delivered at the weight it was supposed to, so they didn't go back and check their sums, and everyone thought that everyone else would give them a little bit of area in the wiggle room, and then you end up with an aircraft which is really, really too heavy, and you have to pretty much rebuild it. And one of the things I loved about this was you also said quite optimistically what you think could be done to prevent this. In that you talk about the air system document and how they sent it to all the different project teams, and actually perhaps they should have done something more with it. And what I'm really getting is The F-35 is a big project, but what is the big lesson you would draw from it for the next generation project? Because whilst we're getting the F-35 in, and that's going to be critical, I'm fairly sure, whilst we've got A, B, and C being built, I'm fairly sure we'll have D, E, and F in service in a few years. But then after that, we're going to have another program. We're already talking about Tempest in the UK. The Americans are talking about the FXX. There's all sorts of things. What is the big lesson you would take from that? If you were advising other engineers in those programs now, what you would you tell them to do and how to manage it?
Okay. I think I'll fill in a gap that I left, for which I apologise, is what happened was when Lockheed got the contract, $18 billion. By the way, it was priced down to the cent. It actually ended in 18 billion, yada, 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 ended in and 1 cent. And they issued it.
What did they do with the 1 cent?
The JORD, they accounted for it. The JORD then turned into what they came known as the air system requirement or the air system document. I forget exactly what it was. It basically, what happened was Lockheed took the JORD and put it in a new cover, put it into the JSF air system document. Now, in the wonderful ideal world, what happens if you're doing a program, any program, here I'm becoming rather geeky on system requirements, and you know, this is one of these niche little things, it's called requirements and management. And if you let a geeky thing get out of control, it can ruin a program. However, if you don't pay it no mind at all, it can also cause you some problems. And my personal view, what Lockheed did, what in geek world, what you should have done is you took that 100 and so many lines and you start what's called decomposing the requirements, i.e. you break them down. Let me give you a worked example. The aircraft shall be capable of being worked from a carrier. So one of the requirements, you then break that down. Oh, we've got to be able to tie it down. Oh, we need to tie down rings on the legs. Oh, we'll need to tie down rings on the wings and tail. Oh, we'll need that. Then you flow that down, you see? And you can do that for every single thing. And to give you the scale of it, for something like JSF, you'd normally end up with something I would think probably north of 120,000 decomposed requirements. Now, there are computer suites that have been around for a long time to track this. The UK uses one called DOORS, Dynamic Object Oriented Requirements System. And essentially what it does is you do all the decomposition and build this enormous database in DOORS. And then what you do against each of those requirements is you do the development and the design and the testing. You know that you've met that requirement, right? Well, that was going to take a very long time, and Lockheed had promised a very tight schedule. So what they actually did was they just took the air systems document and gave one to each of the many teams who were working on the program. You know, cockpit, wing, landing gear, mission systems, power and thermal management systems. They all got given a copy and essentially got told at a sort of mid-level to write their own requirements document. And that led to problems downstream because they started to find there were some requirements in the air systems document they hadn't, that were, if you like, spanned across all the teams. No one team had picked up and said, I'm going to run with that. The other thing that also, I think, I don't know, probably gave them problems on the mission systems. Because, of course, you can imagine if you apply this decomposition down to mission systems, you go all the way down to what does the symbology look like in the cockpit? I not what does it look like, but what do I need it to do? Weight control, I, as a professional, I have to tell you that I think Lockheed's management of weight was unforgivably bad. If you're building a powered lift aircraft, i.e. an aircraft that has to hang with a minimum flying speed of zero, which ends up, it's pure, it's just weight and thrust out of the propulsion system. their lack of control was incredible. Interestingly, they did not have a chief designer. They had an air systems director, but they didn't have a chief designer. And they had a guy who was monitoring the weight, and I and my many hundreds of colleagues were attending technical review meetings where you could see weight going on. They would say, oh, well, we found out we need to put another hydraulic reservoir here, and the weight increase will be X. And this will need to go, oh, the weight increase will be X. And they said, oh, yeah, fine, okay. And there were, I know that there were good people back at BAE in Farnborough at that time with experience who'd worked under Sydney Cam on the P1127, who said, this is possibly not going to end well. So if you're building up, so my duty would be spend the appropriate amount of time on that requirements management, so you know you're designing what the customer asked for. Number two, if it's a powered lift aircraft, weight control is just a must do, and you have to have an iron fist on that. The third thing I think I'd talk to would be optimism bias. Basically, that's the well-known thing that everybody thinks that the stuff they're doing is going to be fantastic, and they've got this nailed, and everything will be right. And by the way, the new technology is going to save us. So this aircraft is very heavy on CAD. They're using advanced CATIA systems, and all the simulation we're doing means that, for instance, if you do a weapon drop on one aircraft, we can read it across to all the rest. Or the flight test will be curtailed because the flight test will just be proving what we've found on the sim. One of the other features of the JSF program was that a lot of the work normally done by government departments was now being done by Lockheed. So, for instance, all the logistics, all the training systems were being managed by Lockheed. A lot of the stuff like clearing the aircraft for flight, a lot of stuff that normally government provided was provided by them. So there were a lot of surprises waiting for Lockheed when they got near to first flight, say, for instance, and the US government said, right, well, before we give it its final permit to fly, can you just give us the man rating for the cockpit? I said, well, that's where you provide a document that guarantees us that all the life support systems in a cockpit are going to keep a man alive, you know, memory. Well, we don't do that. Fortunately, one of my colleagues who'd gone over to Fort Worth with me, my BAE colleagues, one of the many BAE colleagues, had just finished in the last, he did that on the Typhoon. So he stepped forward and said, well, I think I know how to do that. So there were a number of challenges, but I think the key one, if it's a stowable aircraft, control the weight, get a good handle on your requirements, and watch out for optimism bias. And that, unfortunately, means occasionally listening to silly old fools like me who will sit in the corner of a room and say, I think that's going to be a bit more difficult than you think. Perhaps you might like to put a bit more testing in. Perhaps you might want to put another few months in.
Experience has beaten a bit of cynicism into you, hey? I suppose it's that they always call old journalists cynical, and I guess it's because, like you, we've lost that optimism bias.
Yeah, to balance that out, I'd like to, whenever I always advertise my wonderful experience, I always quote, I think, Oscar Wilde, I'll probably be corrected, who says that a person who boasts of experience is merely advertising an excessively long accumulation of stupidity.
True. Yes.
But there is definitely a lot of early optimism about what they were going to do. So
I think they needed to have a chief designer. I think I know they had the air systems director, and I know they have these lovely committees, but I think it's going to sound strange, but yes, we've moved away in some respects from these old titles. Mm-hmm. But I think actually having the person with the title of chief designer, it just means everyone knows who they're going to be accountable and someone knows they're responsible. If you're a director, you run a committee. If you consider the modern structure and the modern management structure, the title of chief designer, I think, is something which needs to be kept and someone needs to have it. And they need to have the authority that goes with it when you're doing these, especially these very big programs. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to say, we've got the current corporate structure, we can manage away without it and all these things. But you actually need that person because you need someone who can go, the paperwork just isn't being good enough. Or someone, let's say like you, who's got experience, can wander up to and go, are you quite sure about this? And who's actually, as they are the name on the, they are the name on the aircraft. They are the name like Sir Sidney Cam, etc. Or all the others, if you think back through the great aircraft of history, who have been associated, all these names, you can always remember to pick out the chief designer, Mitchell, all these things. They go, hang on, my name's going to be on this forever. I'm going to double check that before I say no, because it's my name on it. And I think that's important. It's like when we're talking, I had this discussion with someone recently who was going, well, you know, do modern warships need a captain? Yes, they do, because you need someone who is the ultimate authority, who the buck stops with on board that ship to make those decisions. You can't have it being anywhere else in the world. They need to be on the actual ship when you have a manned crew. When you have a sort of when you have a human crew. So this is the reality, I think, with aircraft, and I think with the F-35 project, I have to say, talking with Steve in the past about this and other things, talking over here about it, I think the lack of a chief designer was a big problem.
Well, in fact, when the and you know, once again, I just want to say, I'm just telling you what they did. The weight got severely out of control on all three variants. Now, the batting order when I joined the program was ABC. So the A model was first to fly, AA1. Then it was going to be BF1 and CF1. When the weight hit, the weight, of course, pinged the B model worst. And this has been reported in the GAO reports. The aircraft was about getting on for a couple of tons, overweight. Okay. Now, that's just miles out. That's not even in the ballpark. That's not even in the country that the ballpark's in. It's probably not in the continent that the country's in that the ballpark's in, right? They formed a special team, the Stovall Weight Attack Team, the SWAT team, with a lot of support from some very, very nice colleagues at Fort Worth. I actually managed to inveigle my way onto that team for my last 6 months or so at Fort Worth, where basically I was providing the ship suitability input to all the weight saving ideas that were going in.
For clarification for our listeners, just to give you a point of reference, those 2 tons are actually slightly heavier than the entire empty weight of a fairy swordfish, which comes in at 1.9 tons. Okay? So basically an F-35B or F-35 was more than a swordfish overweight.
Yeah. It was very, very bad. And one of the things that made it worse was that in the end, it was the customer who told Lockheed just how bad the situation was. The story I heard was that at Pax River at Navair had a team of parametric weight engineers. Now, these were guys who've been doing this for many, many years. Parametric weight estimates are an experience-informed guess. And these guys can make a pretty good stab. If you say, I want an aircraft to have 4 engines and carry this, I'll say, well, it's going to weigh about this. Instead, it was one of the models I did on my master's, Cranfield, so I had a bit of insight into that. And these guys were tracking the weight, and they said, this aircraft's going to weigh a lot more than Lockheed think it's going to do. And eventually it got to the point where they actually said to Lockheed, your aircraft is overweight by X and you're going to stop. And that was quite embarrassing that the government called the stop. And when they formed this lot, they actually put a chief guy in charge who I got to know quite well, and a very nice chap he was too. And they worked extremely hard. And what he did was he was a guy who would, like Alex says, he would make the call. If people say, okay, ABC, we're going to go with B, do it. And he had to get those calls right, and he did. But there was a lot of angst about this. You may remember that Lockheed at one point had gone for a common weapons bay. They said, oh, no, we can make all three fuselages the same. The Stovall would be able to carry a 2,000-pound bomb. They said this in 2001. I said, well, we're going to be able to do this. This is fantastic. Well, then they found that they couldn't, and they had to take it back to the KPP. But people went, oh, that just shows how rubbish it is. It can only carry a tiny bomb. It was only ever asked to carry a 1,000-pound bomb.
Yes, because he knew already that that was going to have such a huge impact on his performance, yes.
Yeah. If you let's talk again. I think Drac will get to see, I mean, some of the very good stuff he's done with ship design. A ship is a big long beam. And you...
Again, the last time Drac smiled like this was when Michael Clapp said, you can call me Michael. There is a big smile coming through.
And you can't cut dirty big holes in a beam without doing stuff to it. Well, if you start putting big weapon bays and holes for lift fans in an aircraft fuselage, you've got to put the steel back in somewhere else. You cannot transmit loads through fresh air. And unfortunately, Lockheed drastically underestimated. Why? Because Lockheed's parametrics for weight were based on the F-16, which is a tube. And tubes are great. You can build tubes really light. You start cutting sodding great holes in tubes, they're not light. And it was basic as that. So they ended up redesigning, I think, something like about 89% of the structure.
And for those listeners of you who are of a nautical bent, when it comes to weight control and issues like that, just bear in mind, going overweight is bad in a land-based project. But let's face it, at the end of the day, if you build a tank somewhat overweight, the worst that's going to happen is it's going to go slightly slower and maybe can't go over certain bridges. If you build a ship overweight, and you'll know I've gone on about this quite a lot, it's not just about the weight, it's also about the stability of the ship. But you can make certain allowances if you end up with an overweight ship, either by sticking, paradoxically enough, even more weight in it to ballast it, or you can unbolt something that's offensive, like a conning tower on top, to save weight and stability that way. On an aircraft, if you're overweight, you're not taking off, and you can't just unbolt a significant portion of the aircraft, and trying to ballast an aircraft with even more weight is not really practical.
Or worse, you do take off and then you try to land.
Yeah.
And let's with too much weight when you're trying to land, you end up going through the deck of your aircraft carrier.
Yeah. Or if the aerodynamic balance is off, you end up doing a good impression of a very expensive Catherine wheel across the sky.
On the F-35B, we had to control the central gravity of the aircraft to within about half an inch.
Yeah. And just to give some idea of comparison, again, for the more navally minded listeners, 2 tons overweight on an F-35B is about 15-16%.
Yeah.
So if you were to translate that over to, say, a treaty era battleship of a 35,000-ton standard displacement, that's the equivalent of launching a ship with a displacement of just over 40,000 tons by mistake.
Yeah. That's giving it an Arethusa class on top.
Yeah, that's the kind of weight difference between a standard battleship and a Littorio class battleship.
Yeah.
Or about 80% of the way to a Bismarck.
we were way out. And the thing I would really like to stress is a lot of people said, well, this just shows how stupid it was to build a stolen aircraft. Well, being no doubt, the A model was non-viable at that weight, and the C model was non-viable at that weight, by which I meant they would not have passed a muster. They would never have been built in quantity. You know, again, it's one of the things that irks me. Just talking about weight, I'll just give you a little fact, which is quite fun, especially for the F-35B naysayers. If you started with the A model as the base and used to get these diagrams you would have seen from Lockheed, we take the basic A model, then we make it into a B, right? When you do that, you gain extra weight. It was called the scar weight for some reason, I don't know. And you had a certain amount of weight you had to add to an A to make it into a B, right? All the fans and lift fans and that. If you then went back to the A and made it into a C, the scar weight for a C was bigger than the scar weight for the B. Now, the difference with the C scar weight is it turns up in the shape of a great big a wing and a landing gear, a system that weighs three times as much.
Because it's going to take part in controlled crashes. Because and that's what landing on an aircraft carrier in Qatar formation is. And it doesn't matter what fancy stuff you have, it is controlled air accident.
Correct. And bits of metal in it, as I was memorably told by my... I got to know the one of the chief designers, Brough, and he described to me that if you look at trying to build the metal into an aircraft to withstand carrier ops, he said, imagine your torso is the fuselage of an aircraft. You've now got to build your torso such that I can put two hooks into your nostrils and accelerate you to flying speed in 2.5 seconds. And when you come back, I'm going to reach up, grab your parts and yank you out the sky by your tender parts. You need to put a bit of reinforcing in.
And for those who don't know this, at the moment, both Jamie and Drax's eyes have gone cross-eyed.
But that translates into bits of metal that don't exist on a land-based plane at all. Okay, so you know,
sea fire all over again.
Well, as I think I said, my late father spent many months in World War II being trained as a high-end sea fire repair specialist, and his job was to rebuild the fuselages in toto at sea, because they were bending so badly. And that problem, by the way, I've just found lasted all the way through sort of Sea Fire 17. So it was never fixed. So yeah, it's big chunks. So all three of the variants were overweight. And that, I think, was a big...
And this is where you started having to bring in all those custom-made specialised bolts.
Yeah, there were titanium bolts.
Everyone being a different size and a different shape for to save weight.
That was where guys like me and a lot of other very good chaps, and we had quite a hefty carrier contingent, were in the SWAT team. And I would like to say I was by no means the only ex-dark blue guy there, but there were much more experienced and much better guys there. And we would hold out against that. By the way, the F-22 went through a huge weight panic, and the Typhoon did as well. And I'm informed that some of those aircraft have some panels that have up to 15 different types of bolts to hold one panel on to try to save another half or quarter of a pound. So we were there trying to do our best not to let it get too far off. And I do actually vividly remember being at one meeting. It was on the access panel for the EOS system, which was quite a big panel, and the idea was that they would take the fasteners by making them all a standard size, you could save £1, and or something like £0.75, I think it was something like that. And one of our ex-chiefs said, well, what happens if you go to two sizes? And we found you could get about 80% of the weight saving in regards to it. He said, well, look, you know, I think go that far, but for God's sake, make sure that all the bolts are the same length. Because one of the things you can do that goes bad is if you make your bolts a different grip length, but the same size, there's nothing to stop you putting a bolt that's too short and tightening it down. And that has happened, and it was a famous one many years ago, a British BAC 111. The main cockpit window blew out at height, sucked the captain out, who got jammed in the hole. And the aircraft came back with the captain actually half in a half hour of flight, with passengers on board. And the reason for that was that the guy who refitted the main cockpit windows had used bolts that were too short. So we said, whatever you do, make them as real standard. So that was really our job there, was as well as trying to make a suggestion. And an interesting thing that the chap who was in charge got us all together. The first day we got together, I seem to remember it was a Sunday night. We were all called in and told basically we were working as many days a week. We would start at 7 and finish at 7. And by the way, there were over 300 of us on the SWAT team. This was not a small team. And we were also told that each of us had to come up with a weight saving idea once a week. And if our weight saving idea didn't get taken up, if we didn't get one weight saving idea taken up every so often, I think a month or two, then we would get sacked.
That's pressure.
Did anyone come up with the idea of putting small helium balloons in void spaces?
I seem to remember that was discussed at one point. There were wacky ones, but one of the best ones I remember, we were all pulled into. Basically, we'd found that at the weight of the aircraft was no longer capable of doing a stow takeoff from any of the USN ships. The takeoff run was too big. And so a whole bunch of us were called into this room with the biggest whiteboard I've ever seen in my life. It was the length of the room. It was a proper big American whiteboard. And basically the chief designer said, right, it's 08. We're not going to leave here until we come up with how we're going to get this aircraft off the and we want lots and lots of ideas. It's not one idea, it's going to be a lot. And I vividly remember it was a Royal Navy guy, a Royal Navy AO, who was over there as part of the government team, and they joined in with this thing, and the government were fully involved with this. Little bit of detail on the lift system on JSF. When you selected powered lift on the F-35, what happened was that the rear nozzle swiveled down, the fan drive was engaged, and two butterfly valves opened in the side of the engine to let air to let compressor air out to the roll control posts buried in the wings. So when you selected powered lift, both those were on. Now, unlike the Harrier, where when it was fully trimmed, the reaction control system was all at zero thrust, you just sat there. And then if you needed thrust, you put a bit of thrust in. The way the F-35 system worked was both of those nozzles were working at a steady 2,000 pound of thrust. Interestingly, that's the same as a jet provost. So the jet provost come out under each wing. And then if you wanted roll control, one would reduce the thrust, the other would increase, right? Well, on the deck, when you launched, you went to the powered lift. So those two roll posts came on. And we were into a couple of hours, and this guy put his hand up. And this guy, by the way, had come up through the ranks as a chief. And he was an outstanding guy. And he just said, well, why are we switching the roll posts on? when the aircraft's on the deck, because all you're doing is you're going up the deck, is essentially you've got two big cons air pointing down, which will generate lots of drag. And you'll probably lose some thruster as well. Couldn't we just, when the pilot makes his selection at the end of the deck, you know, to sort of pull back, can't we get the those valves to work then? And people look round at the guys from Pratt Whitney, and the guys from Pratt Whitney said, yeah, I think we could, you know, they then talked to the guys at BAE who had done the lift system integration. Yeah, we think we could do that. So the guy said, okay, well, you guys go off and work out what that's going to get us back. And that gave us back something like 95 feet. Just that.
Wow.
That was one I could go on, but I don't want to go on too much more. But what I'd like to stress is that to fix the B, a lot of the heavy lifting was done by absolutely brilliant young British engineers. And one of the things I do get miffed, and Dr. Clark will know when I say miffed, he knows I'm, that's a word I used in way of absolutely mind-bendingly, blood-boilingly, eye-poppingly upset, is that people do not give BAE Systems the credit they deserve for the work they put in on this jet. It really gets me. People constantly talk down our own people. In the States, they don't do it. People complain to you in, you know, they'll say, oh, Boeing this or Lockheed that. But I can absolutely assure you, I really get upset when people do not recognize the superb work that was done to help dig this program out.
Well, it's up and running now. The F-35's been at sea for, well, almost a year now, I think. Operationally.
Well, take DT-1 at the point it went to sea. It's a good 5 or 6 years now.
Oh, sorry. I meant in terms of operationally, the they're up in the is it the America, I think. Off the Philippines, out of Okinawa. Seems to be. Haven't heard any bad news, so.
No. Well, in fact, I could share with you guys. I'll just have a quick look. I've got some rather nice cartoons I've done in the past, which was. Oh, here we are. I'll just.
I have to attach this to the show notes.
Yeah.
Probably not. It's probably. It's probably. Correct. I'm going to try this. I'm going to do my share screen stuff. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Share screen. Not the desktop. Try that again. Here we go. Quick bit of. All right, very nice. My extremely nice computer is being very, very Skype. Will not be able to record the contents of the screen. It's quit Skype. No, okay, well, I have to do it later.
You'll have to send us an email.
It's a cartoon of the S-35B about to charge down the deck with the words hack, maim, kill coming out of it and coming soon ocean near you. And one of the most interesting things I saw in the last year, and I was absolutely amazed. And when I saw it, I read it a couple of times. For those who aren't sighted how the USN aviation works, USN aviation is carriers, aircraft carriers. Mm-hmm. And the L class are not, repeat, not a substitute carrier. I was told that one of the reasons that they never put a ski jump on the L class is it would make it look too much like a JSF carrier, and they don't want that. Well, I was astonished last year, I think it was, to see the USMC and the USN advertise the Lightning carrier concept, which is to pack the USS, the bigger LHAs with about 16 or 17 jets. And I was absolutely gobsmacked to use the word carrier for a jet, for an F-35B equipped L class. To me, it's a big change of course. And I think it's extremely, of course I would, I've been with the program, but I put to you that if you can load an L class up with 12 or 15 F-35Bs and you're going to turn up near a bad person, that's your strike force. They need to worry big time, because these aircraft, I think we ought to move on to really what it can do and why.
I was going to say, we've done the typical bilge pump thing here and gone off on tangents and come circles and roundabouts. One of your points, which really does need to be addressed, is your point, which is, why is it not like an F-16? And you've sort of hinted at that all the way through, but let's summarize it here, because then it goes on to the next point as to, what makes the F-35 what it is now.
Okay. Why is it not like an F-16? Good question, well put. I could almost quote from the brief, but he essentially, and I encountered this on the Sea Harrier 2. The Sea Harrier, because this gives me an excuse to big up BAE and British industry. The Sea Harrier 2 with the Blue Vixen radar, the Blue Vixen was an absolutely magnificent radar. It was the first British fighter radar to appear in time to go into the first production aircraft. The first time that had ever happened. Normally, the first few aircraft fly with chunks of concrete in the front. Blue Vixen, executed by the guys up at Ferranti, was magnificent. What was equally mind-bendingly good was the integration of the radar with the weapon system and the AIM 120 AMRAAM. AMRAAM is a big missile. It's a 610 pounds. It's a big missile. And what BAE Systems did was give that the Sea Harrier FA-2 the ability to fire that missile in almost all of its many, many modes. Now, I'm not going to tell you how many modes it's got, because I think at that point, but just trust me, it's lots, and it's smart, so you can launch it to fire and then find the target and execute it. You can launch it to go and search. You can launch it under direct radar control. Then you can switch to semi-active toming. You can get it to tome on jam. It can do it itself. And then you can get the aircraft to do that for four missiles at once. Okay.
Let's see.
BAE
Sea Harrier 2
did that on the Sea Harrier FA-2 so well that for my book, for at least 9 years, that aircraft was the best fighter in the West. The only thing that would have come close to it was an F-16 Block 60. Okay. It was that good.
I do remember someone telling me that it was the only actual beyond visual range fighter we had that was actually really a viable beyond visual BVR fighter that was available in the West for a period, because all the other ones, whilst they theoretically had the capability, hadn't actually got everything joined up, so they actually had the capability, whereas that did.
Well, I don't think I would go that far, because I'm quite sure that the F-15s and the F-16s were viable, but what I do know is that the FA-2 showed me something. What that was this, was that the beyond visual range kill and the capability, if you join that up with networking, so have a multi-ship where two aircraft can work together, or four aircraft or eight, and you could get off-board data, you would rule. And this was proved again and again and again, because as soon as the FA-2 was available, it was all over the place. They were going out to tactical fighter meets, they were going to Red Flag, they were going to all the ranges. And I'm here to tell you that the kill ratios that we were getting were astonishing. And this was not just having a blast. Don't forget the Sea Harrier 2 with the big drop tanks on was only good for about 3G. It couldn't pull G. But the guys, and this fed into the JPO and the Jord, they realized that you did not need eye-watering amounts of G. So the Jord gave G limit that could be traded if required, but they were scaled back. Because, of course, one of the problems with building something like an F-16 is you want something that can pull tons and tons of G. Well, that's great, except you've got to make the fuse. You've got to make it very strong. If you make it very strong, you put more metal inside. Put more metal inside, you can't get all the black boxes and, of course, the fuel. One of the other problems is why doesn't it look like an F-16 is the big difference. And I think the boss used to use a reasonably good one on this one. He would show a head-on view of an F-16. Of course, you've got an F-16, you've got two big drop tanks, you've got missiles out the wings, you've got two missiles under the wings, you've got a pod, you've got a targeting pod, you've got all the stuff is hanging outside the plane. On the low observable aircraft, you've got to get all that stuff inside the skin. And that's tough. And a very good example is fuel. And I covered this when I was doing my master's. Why do almost all fighter aircraft end up having what we call a drop tank? Actually, these days, unlike the P-47 and P-51, the drop tanks have rarely dropped. They're actually held on. Simply, the challenge of internal space, putting fuel into an aircraft is really hard because you've got to build big tanks. And eventually, you end up with a sort of a design process that suffers, I can best way to describe it, a hernia. And the fuel gets squeezed out. Sorry about me. I could call them something else, but I'll stick with a hernia. And your fuel just gets squeezed out, hung in a fairly light construction tank outside. Now, you can't pull all that G with that drop tank on, but so it goes. Well, of course, for a low observable aircraft, you have to get all that fuel in, and that makes a big difference. So it doesn't have to pull the same amount of G because it's towing around all the fuel. It's towing around the amazing amount of avionics that's inside this plane that often hangs bolted on the outside. By the way, anybody who tells you that a great way to do what the Typhoon is doing and just put this fuel on an external fuel, no effect on the drag. Absolute nonsense. Of course it has an effect on the drag. It has less drag than a drop tank, but it has plenty of effect on the plane. Not least, of course, you've now got to react the weight of that fuel through into the structure so that when you pull all your G, it doesn't just rip straight off. So it's part of that business, as I often, when I do post on forums, I say, you can't, you know, it's a bit like Scotty in Star Trek. Yeah, you cannot change the laws of physics, Captain. You end up with the fact that the reason the 35 looks the way it does is it's a low observable strike fighter, and that's what really drove it. But that business of the advent of data linked, network capable, beyond visual range, reliable engagements is the key.
I guess right there is one thing that always jumps to mind for me, and this is my purely based on my ignorance as a civilian, whose iPhone Bluetooth is always disconnecting with every device I try to attach it to, whose Wi-Fi constantly drops out at home, and whose internet server is at least falls over at least once a week. Yeah. Obviously, that sort of thing isn't acceptable in a combat aircraft under the stresses of combat, where everyone's actually trying to cause your network to fall over. I have no doubt that we're walking into highly sensitive area, but I've always just wondered about the value of this network if that network is fragile.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello from the Bilge Pumps team. We hope you've been enjoying part one of Steve George. His returning to talk to us about the F-35 has been something we have all been looking forward to, and we hope very much you will follow this over to part two. Thank you and take care.
Yeah. Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout